Right, now of course, what I don't, what I'm not telling, saying, is that this was all worked out in the Renaissance. It of course wasn't. But the beginnings of it were. Because what they do is they're having to, they're looking at an image or a structure that will house the, that will stand for both the human soul and the image of the universe. Now, there was within Christian culture the image of the universe, which comes together with this ancient image of the tree, was an image of the earth really as the center of the world, center of the universe, with a series of concentric spheres around it. It's the image you find in Dante. In Dante's heaven, Purgatory, what's this? Paradiso. In the Paradiso, where you get this image of the, you get this image of the earth, the sphere of the earth. Then you get an image of the sphere of the moon. Then the sphere of Mercury. Then the sphere of Venus. Then the sphere of the sun. Then the sphere of Mars. The sphere of Jupiter. The sphere of Saturn. The sphere of the fixed stars, the grid realm of the stars, and then finally something they called the primum mobile, the first movement. Right, so this is essentially an image of a human being standing on the earth looking out at the universe. So obviously we know very different, you know, that we've now got a heliocentric cosmology, but they were just doing something much simpler than that, looking at, here I am standing here on earth, I'm surrounded by the moon, and then there are these successive spheres that are that surround us, that compose the universe. And these spheres are, of course, the sun and the seven planets, the great field of the stars, and the divine source, the kind of crown of creation. So that is a sort of spherical kind of model, right? I mean, it's an ascent model where you're ascending from one sphere to the other, and it's found, I suppose, in its finest in Dante's great work, Dante's trilogy, Dante's Divine Comedy, which is, you know, again a Renaissance work, really captures some of the kind of currents that are moving at the time. Now, it's a hellish book to read if you're not very kind of into it, because it's full of Florentine politics and Dante, particularly in his Inferno. Anyone who was mean to Dante in his life ends up in one of the hell realms. But what Dante is describing, and he's describing it in Christian terminology, so it's quite a distorted form in some ways, is the process of descent, because you're in the Inferno, you have this descent down into the earth, in this case descent into hell, and then you start to come back again through the mountain of purgation in the Purgatorio, and then finally you come into the spheres of heaven, and eventually you come into the sphere of the divine. Now that's a convoluted and in some ways corrupted version of that ancient Egyptian tradition of descending into the waters of creation and arising and flowering through the worlds and uniting the worlds together. But in Christian tradition, because human beings are these sinful kind of beings, they end up stuck in hell. Although if you have enough, if you're like Dante, you have a way of being able to be guided through that, you can escape hell and be given a vision of heaven. So if I look at the very first one I gave you, which is the one that has the planets, so these are the Hebrew names of the planets. At this very first one, So at the bottom we've got the earth, which is here called Olam Yesodoth, which means the world of the foundation of the world, which means the earth, the place that we're living in. Levana is the name for the moon. Kokab is the moon for Mercury, the word for Mercury. Nogar, the word for Venus. Shemesh is the word for the sun. Madim, the word for Mars. Tzedek, the word for Jupiter. Shabbatai is the word for Saturn. Mazlot is the word for stars. Rashith Hagilgamin means the beginnings of turning, the beginning of the primum mobile. Now, what you get here is a map of categories, of archetypal categories. So here we start in the sense, and in a way it's not really an ascent map, it's more movement into depth, as we might more deeply understand it. So as we, the key step, which is not never really well explained in these things, is the step out of normal consciousness, normal awareness, into connection with the body and therefore with the earth. So that first movement that we make when we become present in our bodies, present to the inner universe, we start to become connected to the whole world of the Tree of Life. We start to become part of the Tree of Life as we make this descent. And in the Egyptian version, we descend into the waters of life. We become part of something. We step away from our separated sense of consciousness, and we start to become part of the living life that starts to emerge. So from that place of descent, we start to experience. So first of all, they say Olam Yesodoth is the foundation of the world. So you start to experience the beginning of things, the foundation place. As you come into Levana, you come into the realm of the moon, you come into that fluidic, archetypal, moon-like environment. You start as well to connect into some of the deeper kind of, so what the lines joining these are places of connection, because the tree above all is a diagram of relationship. Now the living tree of the Ishad tree is all about the coming to from the point of generation, creating this form that expands and connects and has threads of connection to everything. You know, there's business of the new leaf appearing. You know, the new leaf affects the whole tree. The whole balance of the new branch affects the whole tree. So we're creating, by coming to origination, we come into this form, then it starts to connect everything up. Now this diagram, which is, I have to talk about it, because I want to talk about how to work with the tree. But one of the problems of this diagram, and one of the problems with the thing I've just done, is I've just given you shed loads of information. I've given you all these diagrams, things to understand, things to make sense of, things to learn about, things to get right. And that isn't it, really. But the usefulness of the form is, if we hold it lightly, it's a form that can help us guide our inner process. Because unlike the very ancient Egyptians, we haven't got a structure that helps us. Now their structure was all around them. They have their kind of daily rituals, their kind of inner processes, their cultural forms reminded them of this process of going into depth, of going back to the beginning and returning from the beginning with new life, new ideas, new images. We live in, particularly because now we live in the world, the other thing that's happened since the Renaissance is the rise of scientific materialism, which really starts to kick in around the 18th century, where the world becomes unensouled. Now the kind of soulfulness of the Christian period is a tortured and distorted soulfulness, but it's still soulfulness. What happens after the 18th century and the development of materialistic science is the world becomes deadened. Soul is driven out of the universe. So what we're left with here is a set of images that can help us to connect. So what the Renaissance guy used to do is they used to, so Marcello Fadiscio used to stand at the top of his house just overlooking the cathedral, and it shows what a liberal place it was. He would recite the Homeric hymns. He would sing to Mercury. He would sing to Aphrodite. He would invite Aphrodite into his house. He would invite the god Mars in. He would invite the god Jupiter in. He would bring these images to life within his own soul. And he would set up little rooms where he had images and ideas that reminded him of, say, if he was working on Mercury and wanting to communicate and wanting to be the messenger and wanting to connect things together, he would set up a room that was mercurial. He'd have a little image of Mercury in the room. He'd have what he considered to be mercurial colours. And he would create his outer world as if it was a temple to Mercury, and he would fill his psyche with images of Mercury.
Who was this?
Marcello Fenicio, the master of the Platonic Academy of Florence. And this is the guy who translates all these things, who brings all this stuff back into Europe. So his inner practice, right, was using these old forms to wake something up in his own soul, to connect himself to something bigger than himself, so that energy flows through him. And so successively what he would do, he would have a cycle of prayers and contemplations where he would be connecting up to all these different spheres. So, and in the process, connecting himself up to a much bigger vision of himself. So the part of him is like Mercury, like the magician, like Mercury, or the lover-like quality of Aphrodite, or the radiant and warming presence of the sun, or the beneficent presence of Jupiter, or the clear and energetic energy of Mars. He would invite these energies into his psyche and into his world. And in that process, his nature would change. And he's using this quite integrated form, which isn't as developed as it is here, but is a form that is the image of a human being. So the human being, he would say, the anthropos, the image of the human being contains all these different archetypes, all these different possibilities. So there is a part of us that is very earthed and earthy. There's a part of us that flows like the moon. There's a part of us that's like Mercury and Venus, like Mars and Jupiter. A part of us that is like, that has the centralizing and qualities of the sun. A part of us that has the deep understanding of Saturn and the fiery wisdom of the stars. And above all, there is a deep part of us that is divine, that is beyond all conditions. So this beyond all conditions, right? Beyond all limits. There's a deep at the heart of us, at our deepest place. And they used to do this thing where they would kind of turn the tree upside down and say, well, actually, the root of the tree is here. We call it the crown, but it's actually the root. So we are rooted in divinity. We're rooted, if you go deep down and deepest enough, you're rooted in this place that they call the crown, that is the beginning place, that is Areshi Thagil Gaminl, that is the place of the movement.
Does this still exist in Florence, these rooms?
No.
It's just been written about.
Been written about, he wrote about it. So the Marcello Fenicio translated stuff and talks about it and talks about the things he did. And we can't get it now because we live in a different age, but I mean the idea that he was chanting prayers to the Greek gods in the middle of Florence, not that far distance from Rome. And it was because he had the patronage of the Medici, who were very powerful, that he could get away with it, in other places he would have been killed for it. So but it's an interesting period, you see, because you see the archetypes coming back, but as the image of a human being. And in a way, we're in a similar position these days, having gone through this whole kind of process of of sacralization and scientific materialism, and sort of and the way in which the human imagination these days is not colonized by an all powerful church, it's colonized by capitalism, bluntly, right? Because it's used to sell things. So people, creative people, are valued if they sell things for high value. So there's an elite, a so-called elite portion of society, whose society thinks, yeah, they're the creatives. The creatives are people who sell things that people want to buy for a lot of money. So the colonization these days is now different. It's not to sort of believe in a god. It's creativity. The point of creativity is to sell things. The literal selling of the soul, you could say. Yes?
Can I clarify something?
Yeah.
Was this actual form created by the Hebrews? I mean, was it?
Yes.
They had a sort of.
They had a version of that, right? So let's just talk a bit about that, actually, because it's before. So one of the things that feeds into. One major thread that comes in is this image, the Dantesque image of the spheres of heaven, right? So that's one of the. But you find a similar thing in Jewish tradition, in Judaism. And the Kabbalah in Judaism appears in about the 10th, somewhere between the 10th and the 12th centuries. So this is some couple of hundred years before the Renaissance. But it's actually very secret and private at that time because it's there. But one of the very ancient Kabbalistic books is called a book called the Sefer Yetzirah, which is called the Book of Creation. The Sefer Yetzirah has an image of the tree inside it, and then this idea of these things that are called the sephirot. The word for these spheres in Hebrew is sephirot, which means numbers and or sapphires, jewels like sapphires. And nobody knows how old the Sefer Yetzirah is. It's said to be a very old book. I mean, some people claim it's Christian, early Christian era. Probably not, but it's certainly a lot older than medieval times. So this is an almost slightly pre-Kabbalistic book because it appears before the Kabbalah. The first actual book written on the Kabbalah we find is the Sefer Bahir, the Book of Light, or the Book of Brightness, which appears in Provence in around about the 11th century. Now this, of course, is Provence, Provence and Languedoc, where you get this meeting point of different cultures that creates things like the Cathars. So it's clearly a place where people are underground, are communing and creating lots of new ideas. Later on, you get a similar thing happening in Toledo in Spain. But this is early part. It's in North Spain, southern France, fusion coming together. So it's why, really, that the Tree of Life is connected with Hebrew and Hebrew ideas, because it comes out of that tradition. And what you find happening with the Renaissance Magi get very interested in the Kabbalah, because it's a more sophisticated system than the medieval version of the crystal spheres, because it has you have the relationship possible between the different spheres, which are these paths. And that's why somewhere out of that melting pot we get the tarot appearing. Now at that point, the tarot was not in any way openly associated with the Tree of Life and with these ideas. They were completely separate, as far as we know. I know we're dealing with secret history, so there's no way to know these things. But what you find happening in you get this. The tarot has its own life within Western Europe, and in the 18th century, in particular, starts to be used as a for divination and fortune telling, and sort of, and it becomes this powerful kind of thing in its own right. And one of the very early ideas about the tarot, and one of the reasons why people get excited about it, is they say it comes from Egypt. It's an ancient Egyptian. This is ancient Egyptian magic coming. Now it makes no sense at all, right, in terms of actual, because we know it's developed in Florence. It's not that the Egyptians did not have anything associated with the Tower at all. And they say about it, it is the Book of Thoth. So you get a whole number of commentators in the Tower saying the Tower is the Book of Thoth. So this is kind of strange, really, and certainly once the and at this point, got to remember that people, this is before we understand hieroglyphs, people have, ancient Egypt is this mysterious place that people know about. It certainly hasn't got the kind of the attention that it now gets, but it is seen as this mysterious place. You can read the Greek writers are saying all magic comes from Egypt. So you get this, but people don't know. All they find are these. And in fact, even if you went to Egypt in those, if you go to Egypt, say in the 18th century, you find ruins sticking out of the desert. You don't find excavated things. You kind of, you're walking sort of, 20 feet above the floors of temples. So what you get is this image of the desert and these ancient monuments sticking out of it with these mysterious, quite magical-looking symbols. Hieroglyphs are very beautiful. They're very strange-looking. You know, when you get to the guy called Horopollo, who writes a Greek book where he completely misunderstands hieroglyphs and sort of... but things like this get, this is in the early Christian era, but these books get rediscovered in the Renaissance, and people are reading into them all kinds of things. But what's interesting, if we think of this as a synchronous process, as something that's happening in the depths of the human spirit, is the tarot becomes an ubiquitous thing. So you get this collection of images that is somehow connected to Egypt. And it also, I mean, somebody out in France, they also say it's connected to the Egyptians, to the gypsies, who also come from Egypt. And who are the Egyptians? That's probably where you get the idea of gypsies from. These are the Egyptians, the lost Egyptians who wander the world with their magical cards in their mysterious wagons, who are dangerous and exciting. You're looking puzzled, Jenny. You're looking puzzled.
No, I was liking that idea.
You're liking that idea. Good, I'm glad. Right, good. So something very odd is going on, right? That we have this, all this work that's happening in the Renaissance, and you get this idea of the spheres. You get the idea of the idea of people working and inviting in the old gods and in a new way. And you get these cards bouncing around Europe that gather steam through the 18th century, more so in the 19th century, definitely more so in the 20th century, because there are now thousands of packs. I can remember, back in my 15-year-old days, it's of getting your hands on a tarot pack was quite difficult, actually, and seen as quite dodgy thing to do. You used to have to write off to. Well, Hastings was one place. I used to get mine from Helios Books, that in the middle. Up in Gloucestershire, but it used to come literally in plain brown paper packages. It's very like buying porn, you kind of this illicit stuff. And tarot cards had this kind of glamour around them, so they, they get denounced as they develop, as they're called the devil's picture book. We have T.S. Eliot talking about the wicked pack of cards, which I was in this title of this, Madame Sesostris and her wicked pack of cards. But one of the interesting things that happens in the 19th century is a guy called Eliphas Levi writes a book called The History and Dogma of the Art of Magic, in which he explicitly says that the tarot is connected to the Tree of Life, and in particular connected to the paths of the Tree of Life. And as that idea gets somehow clicks into place for people, the tarot then gets explicitly studied by people who are interested in the Kabbalah and the Tree of Life, and they find it works.
When did this guy write the book?
1830. Eliphas Levi.
What was it called?
The History and Dogma of the Art of Magic, the Art of High Magic. Now, I wish I could tell you that this was a wonderful thing that happened. And it, in some ways, it was a wonderful thing, is a wonderful thing. And I suppose if I was teaching you, if I was teaching a very orthodox course on the Tree of Life and the Tarot, we'd have started with this today. And we'd have chugged through it. Path by path, sphere by sphere, I'd have told you all about it. And had I done that, I would have completely misled you. Because there's a problem with this system. There's immense potential in the system, and there is a problem with the system. The problem is in the very amount of information I've given you. And this is a small... I could have given... Had I wished to give you a lot more about the Tree of Life and the Kabbalah, by God, I could have done it. It would not have been a problem. My printer could be still churning even now. The problem is that the much of the writing around the Kabbalah, much of the work upon the Kabbalah has gone absolutely in our cultural direction in people wanting to know things. Wanting to know, wanting to be expert, wanting to be right, not wanting to be wrong. So instead of it being a fluid, poetic, creative, imaginative system, it's turned into this nightmare thing where you have to know loads and loads and loads and loads of stuff. And if you know enough stuff, and if you know the right people, you get promoted and you get to wear a fancy robe and you get a title and you become an expert Kabbalist. No more deadening thing in the world to be that. And it's an interesting, you know, it's interesting how ideas get perverted. I mean, the word Kabbalah itself in Hebrew means a whispering from my mouth to your ear. It means a whispered secret, telling you something in confidence. This is something secret you need to know. Sotto voce, just underneath the breath. So it's a living transmission. I was lucky in a way, because I got that. I was very lucky meeting, you know, these two remarkable men in my early in my life. At the time I had no idea. I was pissed off with Tom in particular, because Tom didn't seem to me to have a very good grasp on the Tree of Life. Because he used to forget stuff. He'd say, oh, Ian, what's the name of that Sephiroth again? And I was thinking, oh, fucking hell, he's forgotten again. Kind of guy, we should have a proper Kabbalah teacher who would know all about this. And I didn't, you know, I was young and stupid in the way you are when you're young and you want to know everything. And I didn't then understand what he was teaching, which was something much deeper, much more fluid, much more essential. And I, you know, he might genuinely have forgotten because he never did care that much about the ideas, or he might have been doing it to demonstrate to me that actually remembering all this detail isn't actually very useful. Don't know. He's dead now, so I can't ask him. But so we have to handle this stuff with some care. And none of it is at all useful without any of the stuff we've already done today. The most important stuff we've done today, in a way, is these exercises where we're tapping into. And I suppose for me, I'm leaning quite a lot into this Egyptian material. Not because I want to, I'm a bit of an Egyptophile, so that probably helps. But it isn't because I want to turn anybody else into an Egyptophile. It is because they understood a lot more about the art of the living image than most of the societies that have come since. And rather weirdly, what happened to Egyptian tradition is it goes into a time capsule, because we forget how, we don't know how to read hieroglyphs until it's rediscovered in the late 18th, early 19th century. And so most of the stuff we now understand about ancient Egypt has happened in the last 150 years and is still being discovered. And one of the things that's clear about ancient Egyptian tradition is they were centered on the living image, on the work of the living image, and understood it, I think, in a much more sophisticated way than we currently do. That image there of Setne Kamarast, it's a thing called a Shabti. A Shabti is the living image of the person, of the dead person. It was slightly idealized, but as you look, if you look at the face of that figure, you are looking at the living image of Setne Kamarast. Looking at the living image of a man who lived 4,000 years ago. And it's, I mean, it's not true of all Shaktis. Low status Shaktis look a bit generic, but high status Shaktis, like the, that one that's a replica of, is a living image that conveys something of the reality of the being of Setne Kamuast. Now, that's the guy on the table. Yeah, that's the 4,000-year-old magician. Hmm?
The tall one,
not the others. The others are the children of Horus. But that is the living image of Setne. 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 S-E-T-N-E. Setne. Where the Tree of Life can help us, it's not in the detail, and is where the tarot can help us as well, is it gives us a form, a shape, and a set of accessible images that can help us to explore our experience as long as we hold it quite lightly. Now, what the developers of the Tree of Life did was to create a shape that took these ideas of the planetary archetypes, these planetary images, and arranged them in a shape, in a shape of relationship that enables us to see how one thing connects to another. So, if you look at this form, it's got three pillars, two outer pillars, and a middle pillar. So if we just look at that, it's one there, one there, one there. And so what that does is to create a shape that has opposites within it and a centralizing line. So as we relate to the basic shape of it, we automatically start to look at opposites and something that brings opposites together. It's got three triangles in it. It's got an upper triangle, which is that one there, just at the top. It's got a middle triangle around the Sun, Mars, and Jupiter. And it's got another triangle, which is Mercury, Venus, and the Moon. And then it's got one dropped at the end, which is just slightly off the map, which is the Earth. Now, these triangles represent, we could say, levels of consciousness, levels of experience. And in a way, what we're going to do, what we are doing in this workshop, is we're going to look tomorrow, in particular, at the lower triangle, which is Mercury, Venus, and Moon, and Earth. So we've got a little shape there that we're going to look at. In the middle workshop, we're going to look at the middle triangle in more detail. And the final one, we'll look at the top triangle. So, whoever created this image, this Tree of Life, took that image of the image of the universe and rearranged the archetypes in such a way that they enable us to look at the relationship between opposites and how to bring opposites together, and a way of looking at levels of the soul or levels of experience and how things work together at these different levels. So the first triangle, in a sense, really looks at our relationship to what we might call the ordinary sense of self and our ordinary image of the world. The middle triangle, based around the Sun, is a sort of transitional place. It looks at the mediation between inner and outer. The upper triangle represents, if you like, our deepest roots. So in one way we could say that the crown at the top there, or the bottom, depending on which way we're holding it, represents our spiritual root. The place of the stars represents our deep will, place of understanding or Saturn represents our deep imagination. The middle triangle, we could say that the Sun represents presence. The Mars represents clarity. It's about judgment and deciding. And Jupiter represents our ability to be compassionate, to love, the sphere of mercy. The lower triangle, we could say that Mercury represents the mind, Venus the feelings, Earth the body, and the sphere of the moon represents our conditioned imagination, our pool of imagination. It's called the treasure house of images. So if we apply what we're going to do, and we'll do this tomorrow, we're going to apply the methods that we've been looking at today, using the tree, using the short visualizations, to explore particular paths, particular connections. So we can look at the connection between the mind and the body. And we would look at the judgment card in the tarot pack as part of that. Or we can look at the body and the feelings, and we look at the path of the moon there. So we're going to apply, in a sense, the methods we've been looking at today to this form and just see what happens. But above all, the only point of bringing this form forward is something we hold lightly that doesn't obscure the central process of coming into the body, coming into the deep waters of the soul, and arising as the living tree. That's the real tree of life. This is an add-on, a helpful extra to help remind us. The tarot cards are a useful set of images that help us to explore these different parts of ourselves. They're a set of images. For example, the four tens of the tarot pack apply to the sphere of Earth, the four nines to the sphere of the moon, the four eights to the sphere of Mercury, the four sevens to the sphere of Venus. So these are now we don't want to be bound to just these images, but they're handy prompts. They're useful things to play with. So that we are held by a structure that enables us to keep exploring ourselves. So we'll do that tomorrow. So let's just see, and we've only got 10 minutes left, let's just see if there's any thoughts or questions about any of that.